Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. After an inspiring opening plenary yesterday, we are starting today with a more conceptual panel. And the idea was to discuss critical engagements with the discourse of human rights before getting into the panels dedicated to issues such as religion or the media. In 1993, we collectively on this planet decided that human rights were universal, interdependent, interrelated, etc. Almost all states declared that. Civil society all over the globe agreed to that. But the debate on universality hasn't died down. And we still have, everywhere, issues on how to coordinate, articulate our human rights discourse with other forms of discourse, with other ideas. Yesterday evening, we had very, very good examples on how an insistence of certain forms of implementation of human rights wreaks havoc in many ways. Commissioner Tlakula, that's one example, and I'm taking that example because I thought it was striking, told us the story of the 13-year-old bride. And Commissioner Tlakula was humble enough to tell us how pleased she was with herself, with the successful legal recourses she had organized for kidnapping and rape. And yet, as she said herself, what is the measure of success when the child herself hasn't seen her parents since? What kind of reconciliation and renewal, in the words of another speaker yesterday, do we have when we have done everything we should have done by the book and yet we're not happy with the result? There is here a very profound issue with the way we understand and try to implement human rights. We have to ask ourselves questions as to the efficiency of the implementation mechanisms, the remedies we have, maybe more profoundly, the adequacy of our conceptual framework, and we have to engage with other mind frames, something that we have not been very successful at, probably. To do this morning, we have three very challenging speakers. We will start with Professor Colleen Shepherd, from my colleague from the law school at McGill, the director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. We will then hear from Dr. Sally Engel-Mary, professor of anthropology, law and society at New York University. And finally, we'll hear from Professor Ranabir Samadar, founder and director of the Calcutta Research Group and of the journal Refugee Watch. I leave you to read their bio in the program. They will have each approximately 20 minutes, and we'll try to keep at least half the time of this session for discussion with all of you. So we have a real debate, a real discussion. Colleen?
Can you hear me fine? Is the no? The mic, that's better? Okay. Closer. Okay. Bonjour. Ça me fait grand plaisir de participer dans cette panel ce matin. It's a pleasure to participate in this panel this morning and to begin the sessions for today. It's widely acknowledged that human rights discourse is pervasive and powerful. The panoply of human rights instruments and the range of issues they address are impressive. So in this global context that affirms human rights, what does it mean to engage critically with this human rights discourse? And it's this question that I want to attempt to provide some responses to this morning, drawing on examples that speak to the challenges and realities of the Canadian context. First, I think that to engage critically with human rights discourse means ensuring that the rhetoric of human rights does not mask the realities of systemic and ongoing violations of human rights. It's important to resist the assumption that the inclusion of human rights in legal documents means that those rights are respected and protected in reality. One of the major challenges, it seems to me, of human rights in our times is that persistent gap between human rights on paper and human rights in reality. In the Canadian context, I could point to numerous examples, but let me highlight just two. Though we have a longstanding commitment to the rule of law and equality in the administration of justice in Canada, and a constitutional affirmation of Aboriginal rights and non-discrimination based on race and gender, a 2004 Amnesty International report, Stolen Sisters, a Human Rights Response to Discrimination and Violence Against Indigenous Women in Canada, documented a disproportionate number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in our country. Now, while poverty, racism, and social exclusion were identified as factors that contributed to heightened risks of violence against Indigenous women, the report also documented inadequate police protection and inequalities in access to government services, two critical components of equality in the administration of justice and basic foundational components of our human rights framework in Canada. A 2009 Amnesty International update on those human rights violations concluded that the problem persists and that we have not managed to remedy the inequity in the administration of justice in Canada. That Amnesty International update in 2009 also highlighted pervasive violations in the economic and social rights of Indigenous communities, and I just wanted to touch upon one statistic which I found particularly shocking, given that we're in Canada, an advanced, industrial, economically powerful country, economically privileged country, that on the 2,500 reserves in Canada, one quarter of the water treatment systems pose a high risk to human health. Now, the second example, just again to point out the gap between the rhetoric and the reality, even in Canada, is in the domain of anti-discrimination in the workplace. Despite anti-discrimination legislation prohibiting racial discrimination in employment since the 1960s and 70s, and employment equity legislation, which is the term we use for affirmative action in federally regulated workplaces and in many provincially regulated workplaces through contract compliance and provincial initiatives, there are still vast disparities in workplace equality. And statistical data from a Quebec government consultation document, this dates from 2005, revealed an unemployment rate in the black population twice that of the total population, a higher percentage of seasonal work, and significantly lower average incomes in the African-Canadian community in Quebec. Statistics Canada data from 2007 in Quebec regarding the North African immigrant communities indicated unemployment rates of 27.8% or 4.5 times higher than the rate for those in the rest of the country. And that even though 45% of that community had university and technical education and 96% was Francophone. So I think it's significant, again, that this kind of data raises fundamental questions about our failure to implement or to ensure that our human rights guarantees are being adequately enforced in this country. Now, a second dimension of critical engagement with human rights, I think, requires that we think about or ensure that human rights discourse is not used to misrepresent or obscure realities of power, privilege, and entitlement. And how does the language and the terminology we use shape the ways we think about key issues and debates? Now, while much has been written about the very idea of rights, or the risk that rights discourse may reduce complex social issues into individual legal claims on the state, I want to focus on another example and reflecting on how terminology shapes our thinking and how it shapes public debates on critical human rights issues, drawing on, again, a recent example from Quebec, and most specifically, the terminology and the language of reasonable accommodation of diversity in the public sphere. In 2007, Quebec Premier Jean Charest established the Consultation Commission on Accommodation Practices Related to Cultural Differences. And it's interesting to reflect upon the choice of language, accommodation practices related to cultural differences. The commission was a response to public debate and vocal opposition to legal decisions and a series of incidents involving accommodation of religious minorities in Quebec. For example, a legal decision of the Supreme Court of Canada invoking freedom of religion had affirmed the right of a young Sikh boy to wear the ceremonial dagger or kirpan sewn under his clothing at school. Controversies had also arisen about Muslims' prayer space in public spaces and the wearing of religious symbols at work. The debate asked what degree of accommodation is reasonable in Quebec society. Now, in thinking about how we might engage critically with human rights discourse, I think it's important to question the choice of language. Why was it that the commission was called the Commission on Accommodation rather than the Commission on Equality or Commission on Equitable Inclusion? How does our language choices shape how we think about the debates that we're engaged with vis-a-vis human rights? Now, although I'm very much in support of the need for accommodation in many circumstances, the notion of accommodation has been critiqued for the tendency for it to presume the legitimacy of the dominant societal norms, while casting those seeking accommodation as others. With respect to reasonable accommodation, it's important to ask who has the power to define what is reasonable. The appointment of two senior, albeit very highly respected, white men to head the commission sent a significant symbolic message in this regard. As Gwen Brodsky and Sheila Day, two feminist scholars and legal activists from Western Canada, have written in critiquing the notion of accommodation, and this quote was actually cited by the Supreme Court of Canada, interestingly, in a gender accommodation case. They write, "The difficulty with a paradigm of accommodation is that it does not challenge the imbalances of power or the discourses of dominance, such as racism, able-bodyism, and sexism, which result in a society being designed well for some and not for others. It allows those who consider themselves normal to continue to construct institutions and relations in their image as long as others, when they challenge this construction, are accommodated. Accommodation means that we make concessions to those who are different rather than abandoning the idea of normal and working for genuine inclusiveness." Now, in Montreal, feminist scholars at Concordia University's Simone de Beauvoir Institute critiqued the language of accommodation as it was used in the Quebec debates, suggesting that it, quote, "assumes and perpetuates a system of power whereby Western hosts act as gatekeepers for non-Western guests. In this way, it, quote, constructs certain ethno-cultural communities as perpetual outsiders and as threats to Quebec identity rather than as integral to it." I raise this example just to prompt us to think about how the kinds of choices we make in debating human rights issues. The third way, I think, that we can engage critically with human rights discourse is to ensure that traditional human rights categories and concepts do not limit the way, the kinds of substantive claims that we make, or our imagination about what might be possible in the realm of human rights. Often the complexities of social exclusion and structural inequalities do not fit easily into existing human rights concepts and categories. For example, and this is the example I want to pick up, is the categories and grounds used to describe discrimination. Legal protections against discrimination was first developed to redress historical concerns facing particular social groups, including racial, ethnic and religious minorities, women, and to name a few. Human rights documents were introduced to eliminate discrimination based on those discrete grounds of discrimination: sex, race, national or ethnic origin, disability, sexual orientation. There's growing recognition, however, that individuals facing inequality often experience discrimination on more than one ground at the same time. Gender-based discrimination, for example, affects different women differently and is deeply linked to other dimensions of their identity, including their race, ethnicity, language, age, religion, sexual orientation, disability, etc. The same is true of all of the various grounds of discrimination and their interplay with other grounds. And economic vulnerability and social class also impact on the multidimensional and complex character of discrimination. If we take the example of a Muslim girl who is not allowed to play soccer with her hijab, a recent example from Quebec, is the exclusion linked to her religion or her gender or a combination of the two? Separating them into separate legal claims is impossible and risks misrepresenting her experiential reality of exclusion. To focus on religion is to negate the gendered realities of her situation. To focus on gender would ignore the critical role of religion. Moreover, how does her young age factor into the analysis? Now, concepts such as multiple discrimination and intersecting or intersectional discrimination have emerged to describe the phenomenon of overlapping and intersecting inequality. And these concepts challenge traditional legal approaches based on discrete grounds of discrimination. And to me, to engage critically with human rights discourse requires us to develop new terms and new ways to describe emerging understandings of social reality. While some scholars struggle to incorporate an intersectional analysis into legal document, others suggest that perhaps we should shift away from a grounds-based approach altogether and rethink how we understand discrimination in human rights law. Both approaches, I think, are potentially significant and important. Now, the final idea I want to raise today in terms of critical engagement, I think, goes beyond substantive critical thinking about the content of the categories and concepts of human rights and takes us into the domain of process issues. That is, I think critical engagement with human rights discourse requires a rethinking of how, when, and where we engage in human rights. In other words, it entails a critical reevaluation of processes of human rights enforcement. Now, the traditional paradigm of human rights focuses on formal law and the responsibility of the state to prevent and remedy human rights violations pursuant to retroactive legal processes and redress. It's a top-down, state-based model. There's growing recognition, however, that remedying systemic and structural inequalities and human rights abuses requires more participatory, preventive, and proactive approaches. Indeed, some of the most effective strategies for implementing human rights do not rely on top-down, state-based strategies. Instead, they are built from the bottom up and empower those at the bottom of institutional and social hierarchies. The effective enforcement of human rights, therefore, requires its integration into the institutional and community contexts of everyday life. At a broader societal level, seems to me that human rights process issues are also critically important. In Canada, we live in a country of rich and diverse language, ethnic, racial, religious, regional, social, and cultural diversity. And in my view, it's essential to recognize that our multiple identities are integral to an inclusive conception of Canadian political nationality and citizenship. But beyond recognizing diverse communities in constitutional charters and rights, it's important to examine further how our diverse communities engage with each other. To this end, I think we need to nurture participatory and democratic processes of governance that promote dialogue across the divides of difference that separate us. As Simone Chambers has written, a political theorist in Canada, contemporary Canadian constitutionalism, the objective may not be to get everyone to sign in agreement on the dotted line at the end of the day. The objective may be to keep the conversation going. She underscores the importance of dialogue in modern conceptions of constitutionalism. In terms of processes, therefore, critical engagement with human rights requires attentiveness to participatory and inclusive processes of governance in both the public and private communities and relationships of everyday life. Merci beaucoup.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid my French is not up to anything besides hello in French. I'm very pleased to be here. It's actually very impressive that the organizers are focusing on human rights and diversity. This is a fundamental problem in the human rights field, but one that we too rarely engage with empirically and theoretically to figure out solutions. It's widely recognized as a problem. So thank you for organizing this conference on this topic. I'm going to switch to the international domain to talk about this problem, but I'm going to pick up many of the issues that Colleen raised in the context of Quebec. One of the enduring challenges of human rights is the conflict between universal principles of rights and cultural practices that violate those rights but are embedded in local social groups. We typically talk about this as the conflict between rights and culture. Now, this, of course, is ironic because rights is itself a culture, and cultures of all sorts have ideas of justice. But nevertheless, this conflict is typically described in rights versus culture terms. The prototype of this conflict, and I'll give you the most dramatic example that people use to talk about it, is the practice of female genital cutting, sometimes called female genital mutilation, but in preference to activists, as called female genital cutting or female circumcision. This is a practice long condemned by human rights activists, by missionaries before that, yet it's fundamental to the creation of ideas of a modest and pure womanhood in many societies of Africa and the Middle East, and increasingly in North America and Europe as diasporic communities bring this practice to other parts of the world. In theory, the solution to this problem is insurmountable. This is a practice condemned as a harmful traditional practice, condemned by human rights activists, and yet it's engaged in and supported by local communities. It really represents the conflict between the notion of human rights as universal and yet a human rights mechanism that emphasizes choice and agency and therefore has space to respect cultural difference. How do we resolve this apparently intractable problem? I argue that this is intractable in theory, but in fact, if you look at the practice of human rights, we find that there is a far more complex story and that there are actually forms of engagement and dialogue and transformation taking place through the kinds of conflicts and issues that we actually heard about last night. So I'm going to suggest that we think about what's really going on in different parts of the world as human rights discourse is spreading and becoming adopted. But first, I think we need to question the underlying model behind a lot of the international human rights discourse, which I agree, as some of the panelists said last night, is typically thought of as a problem for others, not as a problem for the advanced industrialized countries that are often the promoters of it. Now, being from the U.S., this is particularly ironic since the U.S. is a great producer of human rights discourse and organizations, and yet, as you probably know, has been very reluctant to ratify human rights treaties, oppose the International Criminal Court, and various other things. I just want to say that's not everybody in the U.S. that feels that way. It's always a little embarrassing to come from such a country. The underlying model behind this is the notion that the apparent opposition between rights and culture is the notion of a universal human rights, which is now opposed to particular cultural practices, which is implicitly the juxtaposition of a rational modernity seeking to reform a backward traditional society. And that's sort of the unstated but implicit model behind this culture rights opposition. So the idea is that modernity should create freedom and agency in place of oppressive customs. And, of course, this is why FGC becomes this kind of central focus of activism, because it's seen as an oppressive custom of traditional society. This, of course, has strong resonances with imperial notions of reform, with the civilizing mission, ideas of uplift, and dealing with savage primitive societies. These are 19th century ideas, but they leave contemporary legacies. And I think we need first to begin to unpack both of the terms of this model. First of all, this notion of modernity as a rational space, apparently governed by law, organized around rational principles, where access to power does not depend on kinship, gifts, influence, racial, religious identity. Of course, this, as we all know, is not true. I come from a country where we've had a president who was the son of another president and the grandson of a senator, and, you know, we have connections through kinship of all sorts of ways that give people access to power. And as one tiny example from another part of American society, I did research on a domestic violence program in a small town in Hawaii where I found that women were very reluctant to take their partners to court in cases of violence because they didn't want to offend or antagonize their family, their relatives, their partner or husband's family and relatives. They were embedded in intimate networks of social relationships that really impinged on their attitude towards asserting rights. And this is not right in a third world country, but in a part of the U.S. So our notion of modern societies clearly needs to be interrogated and questioned. And similarly, the notion of traditional society, which has been deeply critiqued by anthropologists, but I've noticed is still alive and well as a category of thinking. It tends to be a notion of unchanged, fixed social practices where people follow customs slavishly. Yet lots of ethnographic research challenges this view and instead presents even small-scale societies as complex sets of rules with space to manipulate, which changes over time. I'll give you one of my favorite examples. There are many societies that say there are certain relatives. These are communities of maybe 50, 100 people. Certain relatives are marriageable, and certain relatives are prohibited as marriage partners. It's seen as an incestuous relationship. But if you have a small community like this, you actually have multiple kinship ties to everybody you know. And so you can choose which of those multiple kinship ties produced by a lot of intermarriage you want to emphasize. So maybe by one set of kinship links, that person's prohibited, but by another set of kinship links, they're perfectly okay as a marriage partner. And, you know, societies will do that. They'll manipulate, they'll find space. There are flexibilities within, not to mention the constant changes that are taking place with external economic forces, political forces, and new ideas like human rights. So thinking of traditional societies as unchanging, full of oppressive customs, is clearly not a realistic interpretation of many societies, and in many ways it's the other that modern society has constructed by which it understands itself as different from that thing out there, which is traditional. We're not like them. There was no such category as traditional until modernity invented it. So if we discard this traditional-modern dichotomy, we can ask instead what kinds of relationships exist between international human rights and local cultural practices when they conflict. More specifically, what kinds of commitments do local communities have to practices that seem to violate universal human rights? Do they all simply oppose or violate these commitments, or are there multiple ways that local communities think about these kinds of practices? I argue that there are at least three different ways that local communities may be committed to or engaged in practices that seem to be violations of human rights principles. Actually, this is really a continuum. These are rough categories, but I want to map them out so you can begin to see that it's not a simple rights culture dichotomy, but that what we think of as culture has multiple versions of how people feel about these local practices. And just to be kind of give you a quick view of where I'm going, there's some practices that are taking place but are not supported by the local community. There are some that are not celebrated but tolerated. And there are some that are actually supported. I'm going to give you examples of each of these. So, for example, if we think about a local practice that is not in accordance with human rights principles but not supported by local community, one example is sex trafficking. There is some, I've been doing research on sex trafficking in general, just did a little bit in India this summer with a graduate student, Vibhuti Ramachandran, looking at how sex trafficking is thought about and takes place. Now, I'm not an expert in this field, but it is a good example of what I'm talking about. There are a variety of ways that young women in general, and as well in India, enter into the sex trade and move into brothels. In general, in most societies, as in India, there's not much support for the people who make this transition happen, those who purchase, sell, facilitate, benefit themselves from moving young women into the sex world. In a few cases, prostitution itself is a hereditary trade and may have different views of it, but the person who's actually making this movement, by and large, is not condoned or supported. Yet, of course, this happens. So this is an example of a human rights violation without actually local community support that nevertheless takes place. A second case are those practices that are tolerated but not supported. And here I'm going to talk about domestic violence, which is a field that I've done a lot of research on. And it's interesting, if you look at a variety of societies, there are differences in how societies view the appropriateness of a male discipline of a partner. Yet in no societies is this really thought to be a wonderful thing. It's not necessarily condoned, but it may be tolerated or accepted. And by and large, there's a sense that certain kinds of behavior warrant certain kinds of violence, but that there is a point at which this violence is excessive. So in no society is it thought to be a wonderful thing to actually very severely beat and injure somebody. On the other hand, a small amount of violence may be thought of as an appropriate kind of discipline. So there's a sense of tolerance but not support for this behavior. The third example are activities that are supported within the local community. Here, of course, we turn to female genital cutting, which is thought to be a way of preserving a woman's chastity, virtue, morality, modesty. It's even thought of as aesthetic. We can think of other examples, early marriage, which is thought to be a way of preserving a girl's virginity until she's married, various kinds of widowhood rituals. Some people say veiling. There has been a move to define this as a human rights violation, and yet, of course, it's fundamental to a lot of religious practice. I'm going to give you another example, which is cosmetic surgery. Now, you may say, wait a minute, that's different. People choose to do cosmetic surgery. And yet, if you think about it, cosmetic surgery is very much supported in societies that say beauty is fundamental, aging is a bad thing. Apparently, this is mostly for women, but I think men are going to get there. Well, they take steroids and other things and do bodybuilding. So this is not just a gender problem. So if you think about cosmetic surgery for a moment, which is booming as a business, is this a totally chosen activity, or is there a sense in which you're sort of driven to do this in a world that defines beauty as being young and thinks that if you haven't actually surgically changed your body, maybe you're going to be in missing out? And there actually is research that shows that so-called plain people have a harder time getting jobs. So it's not clear that this is entirely chosen, and there clearly is a practice that's supported. Now, before you think I'm crazy to see this as a human rights violation, in her 2002 report, the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, Radhika Kumaraswamy, mentioned this as a practice that could be seen as a form of human rights violation. So you can see there's a range of variation in the way local communities feel about various kinds of practices. By the way, it's very intriguing that there's this huge concern with female genital cutting and yet zero concern about male circumcision, which is also actually a hazardous operation with potential complications, scarring, and so on. The movement has not taken off, I think partly because it's widely practiced in so-called modern societies as well as so-called traditional societies. And you can say, there's a consent issue, but of course, if this is done on young infants, there's no consent at all. So these are different kinds of practices, and the question is, I'm running out of time, right? The question is, how do human rights interventions differ in these three kinds of practices? And I would argue that they're quite different. If there is a desire to control non-supported actions, this requires institutional mechanisms. It may require, for example, prosecuting traffickers, creating safe spaces for people who've been trafficked, creating things like village vigilance committees who will notice if people have disappeared, penalizing customers, educating customers about what they're doing, and obviously, far more fundamentally, attacking the global inequalities of wealth that make some populations vulnerable and others able to purchase the labor of those that are poor. So clearly, this is an institutional problem. It doesn't necessarily require education that trafficking is a bad thing. If one looks at the way one goes about controlling tolerated practices, this requires a combination of institutional interventions and attitude change. What I've noticed is that domestic violence interventions typically focus on shifting the line between what's acceptable and what's unacceptable violence. So the idea is to say, well, actually, no violence is acceptable, no matter what you do. I mean, that's sort of the ultimate point. But in the meantime, you say, well, that is too severe. Maybe a little bit less would be a better approach. At the same time, one has to provide institutional recourse for women who experience violence, whether legal, community support, shelters, safe houses. One of the instances about this that is particularly interesting is a system of women's courts that I visit in parts of India called Nari Adalat, in which a group of women constitute a panchayat, a local village court, to which women can come if they have experienced problems of violence, divorce and difficulty getting their dowry back, and the group of women will carry out a kind of a quasi-judicial process. They actually have documents and they write this down and can point out to the men and to the surrounding men watching this process that violence is never justified no matter what the woman does. Failing to cook or take care of the house or take care of children does not constitute a good reason for domestic violence, which surveys show actually rural poor people do think this is an acceptable reason for violence, so that it is both providing a new institution and beginning to suggest ways that attitudes should be changing. This is an example of what I call vernacularization, in which the global human rights idea becomes reinterpreted in terms that make sense in local communities. And in this case, the women in the Nari Adalat said they were teaching women to stand up for themselves. And I asked them if they were doing human rights work, and they said, absolutely. I said, what do you mean by human rights? And they said, we're not really sure, but we know women standing up for themselves is important. So they didn't have a sense of where this fit into CEDAW, but they did have a kind of international justification for their work. They were trained in human rights work by an NGO in Delhi, but they were actually enacting something that was a much more aspirational way of thinking about human rights. When one moves to changing supported practices, the project becomes much, vernacularization becomes much more important. It becomes necessary to think about how you really can reframe the human rights idea to make sense in local communities. So I'm going to give you two examples of interventions to deal with female genital cutting that represent this kind of vernacularization. One is being done by an NGO in West Africa, in Senegal, called Tostan, and they realized that female genital cutting is fundamental to marriage practices. It makes a woman marriageable. So they have organized collective agreements by villages that they will marry non-circumcised women so that if women don't get circumcised, they'll still get access to marriage partners. But this has to be done at a collective level, not at an individual level. A second intervention is taking place in Kenya, where there are group ceremonies of initiation and move to adulthood that don't involve cutting but have all the other features of the circumcision ceremonies, which is really the mark where women go off and learn new things, learn to be adult women, and then return to society as adults. So here, vernacularization becomes really critical. And these are taking place in communities where there are supported customs, but these supported customs need to be are being rethought. Now, I want to go back to my argument about the nature of traditional society, which would assume that there's no way to move a society if people are committed to an idea. And I'm trying to show you that that's actually not an accurate vision of traditional society, that any practice is going to have people who don't like it, who want to change it, who are unhappy about it. And I'm sure there are people who feel this way about female genital cutting who would like not to be doing it, see the pain and suffering it causes, but aren't really free. Sort of like some of us don't want to do cosmetic surgery but may not be free not to do it. So as new ideas come along, new opportunities, there are possibilities to change within a community itself. And I think this is an important dimension to think about. It's not that this is an unfixed system. Of course, this becomes more confusing because political leaders who resist change will sometimes claim that human rights violates their culture and creates social disorder, which is really a way of saying we have to maintain our power and control over the situation which we now dominate. So that is a way of pulling in the culture argument, which makes it look more like the old tradition-modern dichotomy, but in fact may not really reflect the realities of local community life on the ground. Just very briefly, I did some research in New York City where I looked at organizations that were using human rights language to deal with violence against women or other kinds of race, class discrimination. And here it's interesting that the concept of human rights was actually being used in a very aspirational way. Not that here's a document, here's a treaty, you have to follow it, but more that this is a set of large goals about how society ought to be organized, and it served as a very effective mobilizing device. So vernacularization is what is taking place in practice as human rights are reshaped and made local. It's often at the aspirational level, not necessarily tightly connected to conventions. And I would like to point out that what human rights are is, in fact, originally a result of local social movements, particularly in the violence against women field. We can see that during the 1980s, there were all these social movements about battered women and all other dimensions of this problem that then converted this problem into a human rights problem. So the local movements in the first place create the human rights system, which then becomes relocalized. So I think it's important to focus on agency in both local communities and at the global level, to recognize that human rights are complex and changing. They're being appropriated in a variety of ways to deal with the range of social practices that they challenge. They're being vernacularized. They're being constantly readapted and shifted. And also that those that challenge everyday ways of doing things in different cultural settings around the world deal with actions which have variable levels of support within local communities. And these local communities are themselves changing all the time. And the individuals and groups in these communities may well seize on human rights and use those parts or even those aspirations that seem valuable for the particular situation at hand. And I think with this more complex notion, both of what human rights are and what local communities are, we can begin to see how, in practice, this intransigent opposition between culture and rights begins to fade and look very differently.
Good morning. I am much in agreement with what the two previous speakers had said. And I am particularly happy to join this discussion primarily because the question of rights has been, I think, very profoundly situated with the issue of diversity. And the way the two previous speakers have explained the point, I think it leaves not much for me to say something new. I wouldn't repeat what they had said, but I would say that I completely agree with almost all what they have said. But it leads then to a kind of a theoretical articulation which I thought maybe this is the point where I can chip in and add. I would begin by saying that indeed human rights is no human rights that has not addressed the question of diversity. So it's not merely a question of human rights and diverse societies. But the test of human rights precisely lies in its ability, whether as a discourse or as an institutional range of institutionalized claims and all that, is that how much it has been able to address the question of diversity in a society. Now, coming from India and thinking of, as I was listening to them, to these submissions and thinking of our own experiences, two things strike me at the outset. One is that why is it that most of the time in the last 20 years, and this has been, I think this was mentioned even yesterday, that we have spoken of human rights without necessarily understanding or putting to test our own understanding of what democracy is. And at one level it may seem to be a very, you know, very banal thing that I am stating, but think of it that it is a paradox really that we are trying to address, and I will explain why I am saying so. If we say that the society is democratic, then obviously some of the rights are not needed, in the sense that in Canada you don't say that we need right to food, because you assume that most of the people have food. On the other hand, in India, people say we need right to food. Why? Because we think that large sections of population do not have access to food and other, you know, daily necessities of life, resources, etc., etc. China would say we need the right to development. Many other countries would say we do not need that right, or they don't even think the need, that there is a need to articulate the right in terms of development. In other words, what I'm trying to argue is that in this whole discussion on rights, we are not still facing the fact that we are indeed discussing a possible question of the reconfiguration of the democratic agenda. Why is it that in the last 20 years or maybe in the 30 years in most of the post-colonial societies, and I speak here only of the post-colonial societies like India's, why is it that in these societies what is termed as the institutionalization of rule of law has not been enough? United Nations and many other institutions, multilateral institutions, national governments have taken extreme steps to train police system, to train bureaucracy, to institute other mechanisms of rule of law. Press has been, you know, released of many of the restrictions that had been earlier imposed on them. Many of the countries can take pride in independent judiciary, etc., etc. Yet, we know that this has not been enough to institute democracy in diverse society, particularly a society which has a colonial background. Now, take two, three instances, and with which I will be confining myself on this occasion. One is the question of minorities. Now, it is important to ask, why is it that rule of law cannot address the question of minorities enough? Now, if you take the European experiences, you know that there needed, the continent needed bilateral treaties. There were multilateral treaties. There were treaties and a set of arrangements after the Treaty of Versailles. There was the Treaty of Rapallo. There were many other treaties leading up to OSC and a range of arrangements, including Charter of Minority Rights, the Basel Charter and all that. And still, you know, that this is a continent with a democratic setup which acknowledges that in terms of democracy, there will always be minorities. And so polities will be majoritarian polities, which will then be democratic by acknowledging and protecting the rights of the minorities. So you can see the paradox that I am trying to address here, that is at the heart of the whole question of the need to reconfigure our own democratic conception. Now, what is the post-colonial reality as different from, let us say, the Western reality? Take Sri Lanka as an instance, and I am really speaking in very shorthand so that the time is at stake. That in Sri Lanka, from 1948, there were at least three major attempts to change the constitution so that minority rights could be defended. And what did the minority say? And I am referring to the Sri Lankan Tamils. They said, we are not a minority, we are a people. Why do you think that we are a minority? We have as much legitimate position in the society as the, let us say, the Sinhalese majority would be. Or the Indian-born Tamils, who would again say that we are not a minority. We might have been migrants, you know, who had come for tea plantation labor about 100 years ago, but we constitute a people. Now, those who deal with international law know the difference between a group that claims itself to the status of being people and a group which says that I am satisfied with the status of a minority. And therefore, you can easily see that once you acknowledge that these post-colonial societies with enormous diversity at the core of the composition of social composition is not satisfied with the legal appellations that have been given to them for the last 100 years, particularly to the rights-based discourse, one can see why it is not working in these societies and why, therefore, I said that I perfectly understand and I think this is an important point that needs to be re-emphasized, that the argument of a dialogic justice is much more important than the language of rights. The language of rights is finally a language that gets its legitimacy through law. A right that is not recognized in law is no right at all. It's still a claim. On the other hand, a right that will not always satisfy the immanent desires of popular groups, which I term as justice, is something else. And that is the immanent thing for which claims are made. Now, take post-colonial societies. What do you find? At the core of what we say as rights, and I borrow here something which Tilly, before his death, had written wonderfully, he said that claim makings are of three types. One, he said, is that some of the claims are prescribed claims. Democracies would always like that there should be dissent in society, newspapers should report of dissents, and people should make claims, but the claims should be done in the prescribed manner. In other words, you have to be civilized, you have to be gentle, you have to speak in the parliament, you should vote for your party, you should take your party as your representative organ, and the party would speak for you. Do not go to the street and do not be rowdy. And then you have the other kind of claim making, which Tilly described as tolerated forms of claim making. One day you sit on the street, you resort to hunger strike, the British tolerated Gandhiji's hunger strike for certain days. These forms of claim making we don't like, but the regime would tolerate them. But the other forms of claim making, the remaining form of claim making, is what Tilly described as the forbidden forms of claim making. You don't set fire to buses. You don't become mad on the street. You don't show fury in your politics. Your politics has to be civilized and restrained. Now you can see that the way rights discourse has functioned, it has on one hand completely put on the carpet or swept under the carpet the entire discussion on how people make their, you know, claims, how people organize the forms of claim making, how the slippery boundary between what is considered as an accepted form of claim making and a forbidden form of claim making is something that we have never taken into account. Because the fundamental question here would be, and again, going back to what Tilly had said, where do rights come from? Do they come from laws? Do they come from certain, you know, great theorists like John Stuart Mill or Bentham to Rawls? Where do rights come from? Do rights come from the brains of theorists? And the answer is, rights come from contentious politics. Rights come from people when they start making their claims. And when they start making their claims, it depends on actually the particular moment of contention where you know whether the people are actually moving from what was considered hitherto as the prescribed form of claim making to what is now considered as rowdism, as madness, as fury. In other words, politics that is not exactly taking the form of civility. Now, if you look into these kinds of things, you can clearly see why all the arrangements of the minority rights have failed in post-colonial democracies, democracies which are marked by diversities. Now, this leads me to my last point. I think it has been correctly mentioned that dialogue is important. But again, if you push the point a little to its logical kind of end, you see that a dialogic democracy is certainly, it has a profile which is profoundly different from the kind of institutional profile of democracy that we have today. One good example would be, Where do we locate the position of legal pluralism in today's societies which have diversities? I mean, granted that we would certainly respect certain universality of norm. How do you protect the commons in all these societies which have an enormous tradition of retaining the commons which are crucial for indigenous people's lives and lives of many other petty producers? How do you protect certain kinds of dialogic practices in societies, societies in which communities have eternally or consistently dialogued with each other? If I recall my own history, in the sense of my country's own history, one can see that till 1947, there was a very strong, thriving tradition of dialogue. The party which is so well known for being a party which has survived for 100 years, the Indian National Congress, wasn't actually a party, it was more like a forum. There was, of course, a high command, there was a leadership which led the party to national independence. But on the other hand, within this party, you had 100 voices clamoring for recognition. Typically, again, according to the dialogic culture of that time, you could see that in our Constituent Assembly even, you had once again 100 voices that were claiming for recognition. You look into our Constitution and immediately, if you place your ears close to the pages of the Constitution, you can hear the echoes of battle of different opinions and sounds. But what happens after the state is institutionalized, the government is put in place? All you have thereby is an enormous governmentalization of rights and procedures. You want something, government would concede with one hand and take it away by the other hand. You were speaking yesterday of Canada's past, and I was thinking so much of the indigenous people's history in my own country, where the demand for autonomy has been put down again and again. Why? Precisely because the mainstream discourse on democracy does not recognize the demand for autonomy. It does not recognize that democracy needs to be reconfigured on the basis of a structure which would be featured by dialogues of several independent autonomies. So I am not speaking here only of the vertical autonomies. I am speaking here referring to the horizontal autonomies. I would conclude my observation with saying that if reconfiguration of the democratic question is the essential theoretical point in re-understanding the question of rights, then we have to think in some way or another, and this refers to the wonderful talk yesterday by our colleague from South Africa, which is that the whole idea of minimal justice. You see, justice is a thing which groups of population will eternally fight for, no matter whether there is a discourse of rights or not. It doesn't matter. Justice doesn't depend in that sense on the presence of a theoretical discourse on rights. On the other hand, rights always depend on the idea of justice. Now, given that justice will be a perennial kind of dream for populations and for peoples, one has to see how one can institute what I have termed elsewhere as a sense of minimal justice. That we cannot always assure that societies will have maximum justice. And again, in the preceding presentation, I think we had a wonderful discussion and a view of what a minimal justice can be and what a maximal justice can be. The justice achieved in its maximum, one cannot guarantee, certainly from a regime point of view, from a government's point of view, from the point of view in which a society would be organized. That is for groups of people to decide at what level it thinks that this is the maximum of the justice that I need. But certainly, a society has to agree what is the minimal form of justice. And I would say that broadly, five principles would be required for minimal forms of minimal justice. One is that there has to be a recognition in each and every society that wrongs have been done to certain population groups. That the recognition is not enough. That on the basis of the recognition that a wrong has been done, that there needs to be an institutionalization of measures where how the wrongs can be undone, and again to a minimal extent, if not to a maximum extent. Third, there has to be a guarantee. Again, if I take the example of my country, when the constitution was made, the polity was very flexible and supple. There was a plasticity to the entire polity, where the polity gave guarantee to the Kashmiris, to the Nagas and other population groups that after 10 years, after a decade, we will review what kind of constitutional arrangement we had made and whether it has been satisfactory or not. But what happened after 10 years? The constitution by that time is in place. The legal order becomes extremely strong. The government becomes strong. The armed forces become strong. The national security lobby comes into existence. And they say, oh, those were only wishes we had thought, but things are going enough, so we don't need a review of the arrangement. In other words, the lesson is that there has to be a guarantee as well as a custodianship of the measures that need to be taken in order to undo the wrongs. And finally, one has to again agree, as one of the standards of what I call as minimal justice, is the point that even though there is certain, let us say, there is a set of unanimities on what constitutes rule of law, we have to admit continuous improvisation in the polity. In short, what I am saying is that instead of visualizing democracy or envisioning democracy as a set of institutions, probably one has to recover some of the old dreams of democracy, which was that democracy is a much more plebiscitary kind of organization of society. It is a society which has to admit daily plebiscites. In other words, the leaders must daily go to the people and ask if they are doing the right thing. That kind of idea that a democracy needs to be continuously redemocratized, that no democracy is enough, is something that needs to be brought back in order to say that rights is a discourse that will never say that there is an other space where there is no right. Justice never anticipates an other space. Rights always anticipates an other space. We have rights and they don't have rights. I think that's where I shall stop and...
We have approximately 50 minutes to discuss and debate these challenging presentations. There are two microphones. I will ask you to identify yourself, and we'll probably take three or four comments, questions. Please be concise. We'll take three or four comments and questions and then ask the panel to collectively answer or respond to the comments and questions. Sir?
My name is Sam Goldberg. I'm a retired teacher of history. The panel dealt very saliently with many of the complications of human rights theory and practice. But I wonder whether, at the risk of oversimplification, many of these questions are not predicated on the pseudoscientific assumption that the world is overpopulated, and therefore many groups and individuals are inferior at best and expendable at worst. Surely if we collectively believed that life was sacrosanct, then we would be more understanding of diversity and more anxious to make sure that basic justice was available to all. So how do we manage to change this mindset that I think is at the bottom of many of the injustices that we face?
The microphones are empty, please. Yes?
Hi. Is this working?
Yep.
Yeah. Dr. Murray spoke about the need or the usefulness of vernacularization as a way of inserting or moving human rights discourses and human rights ideas into what you wanted to resist calling traditional cultures to some degree. Is there a need, on the other hand, though, to also think about the degree to which traditional Western so-called modern human rights discourses need to take into themselves some of the, for example, justice claims or ideas or cultural practices that are maybe being vernacularized? That is it simply a matter of figuring out how to translate human rights into local vernaculars, or is there also a need to think about how human rights discourses or dominant human rights discourses can learn from those so-called different cultures?
So probably, since there are no other candidates, Please come to the mic as soon as you have an idea. Maybe I'll ask the panelists to answer the first two questions.
I'm going to take a crack at the first question, which raises a fundamental issue about how the social world is organized, in which there seems to be an enduring sense of inclusion and exclusion, which I agree with you is a fundamental reason for various forms of injustices. And if we could deal with the question of why there are these views of inequality in the world, we would certainly be making enormous strides. It is a very widespread practice and doesn't mean that's not worth addressing. And I agree with you, it really underlies a lot of the injustices that we see. The solutions are myriad. People have been trying to work on this problem for a long time, but worth doing. In terms of the question about vernacularization, this is a really important and interesting issue because every society has conceptions of justice. And ideally, we would have ways that all these different notions about what's just and fair could become part of an international community. I think we now confront a world in which there is the dominant discourse of human rights, which is the way that justice claims tend to be made that can be heard internationally. And yet, rights is not really a very effective vehicle for a lot of the kinds of justice claims that people want to make. It forces everything in terms of an individualistic claim rather than thinking about the need for more just distribution of resources in general. I actually think the kinds of ideologies that socialism offers provide a better framework for a lot of the kinds of justice concerns that we have. And yet we confront a world in which right seems to be, in practice, the way claims have to be made. So that instead of talking about the obligations of states or society to provide some kind of social equality and food for everyone, we have to talk about a right to food, which in a way is a kind of an incoherent concept. Who is to provide that right to food? What does it mean to have a right to food? So I think we live in a world where these issues are being put into a box that doesn't necessarily fit that well. And I think that is kind of the current empirical situation that we live in, but hardly ideal. In terms of the way local ideas of justice become responded to, I think it's really interesting to see that even given the limitations of the human rights framework, the way that these issues have been defined is often the product of local struggles. And I'll give you an example, violence against women, which is the area I've looked at. Now, with the category of violence against women is now a pretty incoherent, broad concept. It's sort of like genocide. This is a useful category, and everything gets dumped in it. And when we look at what is in that list, there are lots of local issues that have been brought up and made as a generic human rights problem. So it includes things like dowry murders, child marriage, acid throwing, beauty practices. A lot of the leveret, the fact that after a woman's husband dies, she should marry her brother, his brother, which is, again, part of a kinship system. So what we've seen is lots and lots of specific local and national issues, honor killing, another one, being tossed into this big container of violence against women. So it's not that there aren't local issues and concerns being defined in global terms, but I think that multiplicity of ways of thinking about justice are not being incorporated into this framework, and I think that's a real problem. And if there were a way to make a more open-ended framework, that would be useful. I will say that the complication here is that the language of human rights does have a universality to the way it deals with issues and defines issues, which increases audiences. And I'm going to give you an example, and I'd like your reaction to this example. But I know that in the World Conference on Racism in Durban in South Africa in 2001, one of the issues that some groups were very anxious to get heard was the question of whether caste differences in India constitute a form of race discrimination. And my understanding is that the Dalit groups were very actively mobilizing and claiming that this was a race problem, and India was unwilling to recognize that the category of caste should or could fit into the category of race. And I have been talking to human rights activists, and the argument is that if you define caste as race, of course caste isn't the same as race, but there are some similarities, you then put this into a category that's familiar to the rest of the world. But if you say it's caste, then it becomes local cultural practice and is less vulnerable to critique. So using the human rights framework puts local practices into terms that make them understandable and accessible to other kinds of audiences. They also violate the meanings of those violations in some ways, but they open them up to larger sets of critique. So it's a complicated question about how and where using this discourse both makes violations more accessible, but also to some extent strips them of context and locality.
Ranabir, a reaction on that? Or Colleen wanted to say something.
No,
go ahead.
Go ahead,
and Ranabir will react afterwards.
Okay, I just wanted to respond a little bit to the two questions. The first, if I understood correctly, spoke about the difficult the mindset that justifies injustice throughout the world. And it made me think of, in some ways, I think that there are indeed, I think, many problems of human rights violations which are linked to malice, intentional bad faith, and abuse of others. However, I just wanted to raise the idea that in many instances, I think there's a widespread concern about justice, about ensuring that we move towards a society that's more fair, that's more equitable, and yet individuals don't know how to move in that direction in light of the kinds of structural and systemic inequalities in which we find ourselves. And so we're embedded in these institutional, systemic, structural, international settings where we're not sure how to move from a situation of injustice towards a world that's more just. And in the legal domain, I think we've been historically most at ease when we see an instance of individual misconduct or violation, which we can then point to and redress after the fact. And we can identify a clear individual wrongdoer. I think one of the challenges with a lot of the structural and systemic human rights violations is that we need to think about how to use law and legal concepts to change systems and structures and embedded patterns which result in significant inequalities. And it's very difficult to know how to do that, even if one has an individual desire or will. It can be overwhelming, or we're not sure how to use legal concepts towards systemic change. So I just had that thought. And in terms of the idea of rights and human rights discourse, I think it's true that in many ways, again, we think of rights in terms of individual claims. But I've also been influenced by many scholars who speak of rights as demarcating the kinds of relationships that we have in the world, and that indeed one's individual right cannot be separated from the relationships that one has with others, and that rights claims in many ways are about starting a conversation with others about one's needs and concerns, and they're integrally collective and not simply individual. So I just wanted to add those two ideas.
Right here.
No, on the question of caste and race, and I think this also leads to my reflection on the first question, and I will take them together. I seriously think that the race question has, we are so uncomfortable with the race question because of our own, a traditional way of understanding race, that we do not like to accept the fact that democracies actually coexist with race, ideas of race, racism, and democracies are comfortable with that. And this is not something which is exceptional. It has been from the beginning. From the beginning of the democratic discourse, there is, if one goes to the history of the race discussion, one can see that democracies had always been, at one level uncomfortable with the reality of the whole, argument of races. And while democracies would like to do away with that, on the other hand, it has no answer, again, as an idea, it has no answer to the continuously essentializing social practices, cultural practices, political practices, and certainly economic practices that finally then turn a population group into as if it has certain biocultural essential characteristics which would lead to the appellation of race. Now, and this has implication for the way in which democracies treat the migrants. It has implication for the way democracies take the or negotiate the problem of kinship, particularly again in post-colonial countries. This has implication for the religious question, community question in post-colonial countries. I mean, one can go on discussing that, but I stop at that. You see, and therefore what happens is that if you take the question of caste, now, what happened in India was that there were certain militant caste Dalit groups which wanted, and I think for right reasons, wanted that this be recognized as a race problem, that India has a problem of racism. Internally, however, this didn't have much impact on the Dalit politics. It much more the impact that the country has to now face is the way in which the entire Dalit argument about what is termed as dignity is much more important. And this call for dignity that you cannot, democracy, the Indian democracy cannot negotiate or solve the problem of Dalits only by instituting reservations or only by creating a permanent commission for scheduled castes and scheduled tribes which have now been separated into two commissions, or by institutionalizing certain welfare measures. What is much more important, to the extent that I understand the way in which Dalit politics has shaped itself in the last few years, is the importance, the significance that it gives to the question of dignity. How much dignity the polity is to offer or is to recognize of the Dalits. Now, that argument, the argument of the dignity, is an old argument. It's not a new argument. In fact, from the late 19th century, when the first militant Dalit discourse was shaped by one of the most well-known reformers, Jyotiba Phule, to the militant Dalit arguments during the anti-colonial time, you can see again and again the dignity argument is coming up. Now, this has, I think, reverberations, and in the way, it has similarities with the movement of the colored people for dignity. I will stop with, you know, reminding myself of something which I had read long back. It's an autobiography of Malcolm X, and where there was a white young boy, I think a college undergraduate, who had gone to Malcolm X and had said that we want to help you. What do you want to do? What is the kind of help that you need? And to which probably Malcolm X was in a very irritable mood at that time. I do not know, but I read the. He said, enough, stop. So many people daily visit me and offer me their help. I don't need it. Just go back to your own society and be comfortable with your society, but just remember that we are also there on earth. Just don't discount us. Now, this is the language of dignity. Now, this is not the language of ending differences in the liberal sense of the term. But it's the language of claiming certain type of recognition or a depth of recognition that a liberal democratic polity is unable to offer. Now, what I am therefore trying to tell is that the globalizing nature of certain type of discourse has the power to erase those, how would you put it, those small eyes of the needle through which actually historical events occur, through which actually really large and, you know, deep events occur. So the fact that in India that you have a Dalit movement which at one level may say that, well, it is clear that it should be incorporated into anti-racist discourse. But on the other hand, this is not enough. What we want is something else, which they term, Dalits would term as dignity. I would certainly go along, you know, by the term. But it would mean something more. And today, if you see in India, today in India, there is one state which is ruled by the main party of the Dalits, and the chief minister's name is Mayawati. If you see the type of politics that goes on, you can clearly see that the way in which the politics of recognition and at the same time the politics of appropriation of certain social symbols, values, political resources are going on, that really needs for a much more local investigation into what actually justice means in particular contentious contexts, contexts which are marked by deep contentions about claims about different people. And what the, therefore, the evolving trend is, how do other castes, if one really thinks in the caste framework, how do other castes, you know, look to these kinds of things? What is the kind of interface that is appearing? And to conclude, even more important point is that how do Muslims, if at all they are to be taken as a separate category, because religion cannot be the only marker of constituting a population group, how do Muslims look at the whole question of caste? Because in India today, we had a commission which wanted to look into the conditions of the Muslims, and they came out by and large with one recommendation that Muslims should be placed in the OBC status, which means the other backward communities. So you can see that the caste glasses are very powerful, and the term race actually does not exhaust the enormous amount of implications that are there in the social life when we use the word caste.
Thank you. Yes?
Thank you very much. My name is Anver Iman. I teach at the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto.
Good.
And my area of specialty is actually Islamic law and legal history. So I was wanted to come to the question of rights that you've been addressing from a different perspective. What I'd like to do is ask you about rights in the context of what Talal Asad has suggested is the formation of the secular, and thinking about the way in which what becomes possible as a right, even if we take into account the vernacular or the contextual, there are certain presuppositions of which contexts count, which interests matter, what languages actually matter. And just to use as an example, yesterday the Right Honorable Mr. McShane from the UK Parliament made an interesting comment to me, to the audience. He said he was struck by how Muslims in Europe, with specific reference to Tariq Ramadan, would not condemn lapidation. And said something to the effect that, you know, they won't do it because it's in the Quran, and so therefore they cannot challenge it. And then made a reference to how we have dealt with that in the Bible long ago. I personally am not entirely certain if we have dealt with that in the Bible long ago, given the politics of the Tea Party in the South and Orange County and Orange County's Republican tendencies towards Proposition 8 in California. But it does raise an interesting question about pain that Asad raises as well. He talks about pain in religious traditions as redemptive, speaking about Christian martyrs, the stories of Christian martyrs in which pain plays an eschatological role. And likewise, some might say that the rationale, the ratio of Islamic legal punishments has something to do with pain preserving your place after life. So the only way to make sense of Mr. McShane's comment is therefore to accept a secularist thesis about time. Time in this life, time not thereafter. And so part of my question then is, to what extent when we engage in rights discourse, are we implicitly framed by assumptions that we're not actually accepting, that we're taking for granted? And does part of the process of thinking of human rights in diverse societies first require us to think about the way in which rights are themselves framed by a modernist secularist discourse? And again, I invoke the notion of pain in Assad's work, as well as the comment by Mr. McShane, to illustrate the limitations The second comment that I, second question that I ask is, in the title of the conference, it's Human Rights in Diverse Societies, but rights, in my mind, both as a professor of Islamic law and as a torts professor, are rights that are adjudicated, usually by institutions involving the state. And nowhere in the title have we addressed the way in which human rights are mediated by the state. So to what extent, in the story, for instance, from South Africa yesterday, when we have the young girl who was married off by her father, on the one hand, we have the vindication of individual choice by the girl as against the values of a community, but those individual choices are values adopted by the state. There was a violence done to the community by the state. She was removed and is no longer part of a family community because of the state. And there's a sense in which I also want to ask you how you would think about human rights as principles of state formation, principles of national identity that introduce a different society, not just different cultural religious societies, but the notion of states as the legitimate agents of coercive violence in the name of human rights. Because it seems to me that is part of the question that is behind some of the issues and concerns that we have and that I've been hearing in some of the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other question, comment while we're at it? Go to the microphones, please.
Hello. My name is Christina. I'm a participant of Young Leaders Forum. And I would like to ask a couple of questions. I'm originally from Armenia, but I live in Netherlands. And as I can compare human rights in Armenia and Netherlands, their understanding, their complex, they are totally different. So what need people in Armenia and what need people in Netherlands, they are very, very different. But at the same time, legislation which is used in these two countries, they are quite close. So if you read law, it looks like everything is more or less the same. So my question is, how do you think human rights, it must be something universal, so it must be like some box. And if you put everything what should be inside, so you can say, okay, human rights is respected. Or human rights, it should be something different for any situation depending on the country. And in this case, so the respect of human rights should be defined as going one step forward in each situation. And another question I wanted to ask about human rights in general. How can you define the difference between human rights and rights of people in general? For instance, if any right which belongs to a person can be defined as a human right, or human right is something very special which has some special ground? And if so, what can be the ground for the determination of human rights? Legislation, which is very often, especially in developing countries, is not relevant to the country, or there can be some another ground. And a third small question about the legislation in general. In many developing countries, the legislation looks very, very similar to the legislation in well-developed countries. Do you think this approach is correct and it can be effective and it can somehow contribute to the development of human rights? And if no, how to think, what can be the solution? Just developing some another legislation for developing countries, which includes like less rights, like you don't need much, just some minimal for you. Or I think this approach is correct, and so copy and pasting the legislation existing in developed countries for developing country can really lead to the development of human rights in these developing countries. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to ask a question? I saw you move toward the microphone. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd rather hear the young people's questions than to hear my own voice. I get to talk this afternoon, so.
Okay. So the young voice, please.
Hello. Thank you so much for a very engaging discussion and issues. My name is Thuy Nguyen. I'm from the Faculty of Education, and I'm doing my doctoral studies about inclusion and exclusion in a non-Western country, that is Vietnam. And so I'm so thankful for the critical issues that you raised about human rights, inclusion, exclusion, and injustice. I'm reflecting on the issues that we have been addressing since yesterday. And what is so important for me to think about is issues about the magnitude of injustice that happens not only within the local community, but also at the national context. And also, I also think about the global dimensions of injustice that we're now thinking about human rights on the one hand, but we also need to think about human rights alongside other issues such as development, which the global institutions like the World Bank has been trying to impose on developing countries. And so I'm thinking about one of the books that I've just read some time ago about human rights horizons by Richard Falk, and a very recent book by Eve Darren Smith, when she talks about issues of rights and how rights has emerged within the context of institutional building, and it has the politics of domination that applies to different societies. So how could you reconcile the issues of justice, which is not only applied to the local and national context, but also within the global context? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have enough questions for the moment. There's a lot to discuss. Colleen, do you want to say a few? No? Whomever wants to start.
Well, I'll give a short.
Go ahead.
While they think of longer answers. So, okay, again, the very complex, interesting questions and comments, and I think they, in some ways, don't need answers, but I'll venture to add some ideas to the debate. With respect to the first question, I want to just pick up on the idea of the state as a source of legitimate coercion and violence, which I think is really important. And indeed, in some way, and the role of the state is obviously complex. And interestingly, in terms of the traditions of civil liberties, fundamental freedoms, in many ways, the classic civil and political rights documents conceptualize the state as the source, the primary source of violation of fundamental rights, and rather than seeing private actors as the source of violation. And indeed, it's been only more recently with the greater focus on economic and social rights where we've begun to emphasize more fully the role of states in ensuring and acting positively to protect and secure some fundamental basic human rights and well-being. So I think it's important to keep those dual roles of the state in mind. And I agree with the speaker that it is we need to sort of remember that duality in terms of the role of the state having this being a source of coercion and violence, as well as potentially a source of protection in our debates about human rights. In terms of turning to the second, and as I said, I'm just going to touch upon add some ideas to the dialogue here. The second question, which asked about human rights as universal versus the context within which rights are exercised and actualized, I think that it's interesting that we've been talking about very big concepts, even concepts like equality, liberty, freedoms, human dignity. They're concepts which don't have any fixed meanings, and they're given meaning, I think, in the specific context within which they operate. And there is a way in which I think that's important and positive to think about the ways in which, Sally spoke about the vernacularization, the ways in which there is a normative force to those terms, which I think is important to celebrate, but their meaning, I think, will necessarily vary depending on the local context within which they arise. In terms of the question of human rights as universal in terms of a static sense versus the idea that human rights are going to be actualized progressively. I think we can see that in the human rights domain there is a practice of reporting, particularly with respect to economic and social rights. The idea is that they are goals towards which countries will move, and that the idea is that there should be a movement in the positive direction rather than a retreat. And that idea, although it's not ideal, we may want human rights to be actualized immediately, but the idea of not moving backwards, I think, is something that needs to be emphasized and insisted upon. And just on the copying and pasting and legislative initiatives, I really think that the legislation needs to be built within the local context within which it, taking into account the contextual realities of the local country rather than a cutting and pasting model for legislative reform, just on that. And just one final idea, in terms of the global dimensions of human rights, the last question. I think it's also interesting in terms of the structures of human rights enforcement have tended to focus on nation states as those who are responsible for human rights violations within their countries. And that perhaps may not be adequate in a global context where what happens in one country is integrally related to what's policies and decisions which may be made in another country. So it seems to me that we may want to rethink our frameworks of international and global human rights to ensure adequate international and global responsibility where necessary, rather than simply conceptualizing responsibility at the state level. So I leave to my esteemed colleagues the task of adding further to those challenging questions.
Yeah, thank you all very much. Those were a lot of great questions. I'm going to make some effort to say things about them, but there's much more to be said. First of all, human rights are indeed resolutely secular. Some people have called this a civil religion so that there's a dimension of faith to it. But really, the major alternative justice ideologies in the world these days are religious. And they are also global, not quite as global as human rights in their scope, but I think this is an important point worth remembering, and I should probably have mentioned this earlier. And there are a lot of ways that the secularism of human rights is part of the discourse, and of course in that sense violates a lot of notions of justice elsewhere in the world. The relationship between human rights and states is really a very important and curious thing. The modern human rights system was developed out of the Second World War, as you know, out of the Holocaust, out of a deep distrust that states could be relied on to protect their own citizens. And it has meant, over the last 60, 70 years, a redefinition of the notion of state sovereignty, in which states are no longer thought to be capable of governing their populations without external supervision or consultation. That being said, the focus of human rights activity is on the state. And if you go to human rights hearings, if you look at how the whole process works, it's always about getting states to behave differently. Now, this has a couple ironies in the fact that the states are thought of as the problem, and yet they're also the solution. Secondly, there are actors that are left out of this whole system. Civil society is seen to be an important ally, but the whole corporate world has really been displaced and marginalized in this process. And yet, as we know, corporate activity is often responsible for lots of human rights violations, environmental problems, et cetera, et cetera. So what's happening now is an effort to bring the corporate world into the human rights system in a variety of ways that may or may not be actually very effective. One is this move towards corporate social responsibility, towards human rights standards for corporations. This is, at this moment, an entirely voluntary system. There are a couple global mechanisms, the Global Compact and the Global Reporting Initiative, in which corporations are tasked to report themselves how well they're complying with the human rights standards, and they provide the data, and they're supposed to give reports. So it's not clear how effective this is. The other thing that's happening is the emergence of so-called public-private partnerships, in which the idea is that states are actually not powerful and wealthy enough to carry out these human rights reforms on their own. We need to rely on corporations. And if any of you look at the program for the Millennium Development Goals Summit that was in New York a week or two ago. It was full of these public-private partnerships where, just to give you an example, a group of oil executives in the Emirates are working together to promote human rights around the world. And, you know, I think this is not to pick on oil executives, but the whole logic of corporate activity is about profit, and the logic of government is about protecting the public welfare, and it's not clear to me that those are going to go together. And I think we need to worry about increasingly expecting the corporations are going to be the vehicles to promote human rights, social justice, and the betterment of the public. I think there's reason for skepticism. I think a different approach might work better. Human rights are universal but different in different countries. This is very true. Human rights is actually a very complicated system. There are lots and lots of things in it. There are many claims to human rights ideas that are not actually embedded in any human rights document. Maybe they're in the making. Maybe they're going to get there. One of my favorite is the human right to nudity, which some people claim. I don't think it's in any document. LGBT groups are now talking about human rights, but there are no, as far as I know, human rights documents that include any sort of human rights protections for LGBT activity. But this may be coming, just like gender violence was not a human rights violation until about 20 years ago when social movements made it happen. So different countries may pick up different pieces of human rights violations. I just read a paper about Belarus, which apparently has a very authoritarian government, but has jumped on the trafficking issue as its great heroic accomplishment, which it then uses to control its population movement in the name of protecting from trafficking. So, you know, you can have countries sort of manipulating the system very easily, as well as organizations. What's the legitimacy of the human rights system? I think somebody asked, in essence. I mean, this is a huge, complicated question. If we look at the modern human rights history, there's no doubt that this came out of Western ideas about liberal relationships of the individual to the state. This was formed, our modern system formed during the Cold War, so the kinds of social, economic, cultural rights were essentially what the East wanted included in the human rights system. And that's why we have civil and political, as well as social, economic, and cultural. There's an endless struggle to make these equal. The collective rights, like indigenous rights, are clearly a subordinate trailing importance within the human rights system. So many things are more important than others. Insofar as human rights has legitimacy, and, you know, this is an empirical question, it seems to me it's based not on philosophical arguments or some kind of global idea that it's linked to other ideas of justice, but in fact the process itself whereby these are multilateral treaties, countries have signed on, there's some recent evidence that signing on to a human rights treaty may actually change what some countries do. A new book by Beth Simmons makes this argument. So there is some sort of social legitimacy of this, but anybody who says it's not a fundamentally Western ideas, you know, historically that's just not true. So are rights the same as justice? Not necessarily. And one final point, and that is human rights are increasingly becoming a policy issue connected to things like development and humanitarianism. There was previously the idea that the human right was a trump. You know, you would say, oh, that's a human rights violation, you have to stop. But as it's becoming more popularized, it becomes part of other sorts of policy planning. So we now talk about health from a human rights perspective. UNICEF is adopting a human rights perspective. Development work, right, we have this whole notion of human rights and development, and exactly how this shifts these other agendas is unclear, but it no longer is this overarching trump, but another policy consideration that focuses on the way excluded or vulnerable populations should be given particular consideration in these other kinds of initiatives, and this is probably going to change what human rights looks like. I'm done.
You know, on some of the things what you said about the rights, allow me to strike a certain note of discord on one or two things. I really think that today, meaning 2010, the kind of arguments that we heard, you know, I will take some of the questions together, that whether rights that indicates the formation of the secular and all that, pardon me for saying little more crisply, that it reminds us of a discourse which is over by 10 years at least. At least by 10 years. This whole idea of secular and the religious. I mean, Foucault has shown that what we consider to be secular is deeply marked by Christian discourses over 1,000 years. Now, we have always taken for granted that this is the language of the secular and this is the language of the religious. This is the language of the universal. This is the language of the local. This is the language of the state. This is the language of the community. While this is true, but let's not be prisoner to the given binaries. And I will again make my remark very short. Think of history, and why is it that in human rights, why we do not think of history? It's a historical thing. India. The part 3 of the Indian constitution is known as fundamental rights. It was drafted exactly at the same time when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was drafted and declared. I was a student of political science. I never heard of UDHR and universal language of human rights, while I was learning at the same time that Indian constitution has given me rights. So the idea that rights have a universal language, that the rights belong to the domain of the secular, that the rights have in some sense a kind of origin that we go back to again and again, we cannot forget, is something that I think by itself needs to be problematized. Here is a person, Jamaluddin Alafghani, someone, you know, remembering or recalling Talal Asad's. I don't know how he would have reacted to the instance that I am now giving before you. Jamaluddin Alafghani, he was a Shia. He was a cleric in Turkey. He, at the same time, was the formulator of some of the finest ideas of anti-colonial Islam. He visited India from 1840s to 1860s. And when he was passing through Afghanistan, he realized that Shias and Sunnis must be united if they have to present a common front to colonialism, particularly British and French colonialism. He took on the title of Al-Afghani of Afghanistan. He wasn't a Sunni. And then he came to India and helped the Wahhabi movement of that time to draft one of the masterpieces of Wahhabi literature, which is The Rights of the Islamic People of India Against the Queen. And to tell you a little more of the story, this was around the time when the great mutiny of 1857 had happened. And the Wahhabis, when the British troops were almost about to capture Delhi, they issued a leaflet to the Hindu traders saying, I know that you hate us, but we also know that you are taking opportunity of the crisis and increasing the prices of the grains. Your Hindu brothers are also suffering. We are also suffering. We can guarantee that when God's rain would come, we would not destroy you. You would also have a place. But now we are fighting against the Christian race. Now, if you forget the part of the Christian and all that, you can see that we have forgotten, again I am saying we have forgotten history, that rights originated in national contexts. Democracy originated again in a national context. It is only today, with this dangerous, as you might call, the liaison between democracy and globalization, that we have forgotten that nations still do have their rightful places on earth. That nations still think in terms of rights, and that people, when they think of rights, they think of the national space within which they can argue for rights, they can voice their claims, they can, you know, find out the language of their, what the justice that they think is really due to them, and they demand institutionalization. That is what happened in India. That is what happened in 1914 when Jinnah and Gandhi entered into a pact called the Lucknow Pact to say how the colonized people would voice their rights. Now, is it a language of the secular? I'm not going to really say that it can be reduced to that. I would rather say that the binaries themselves need to be problematized. they need to be taken actually as problems that need to be much more historically inquired. And history does give us enormous lessons on the whole dynamic and the contingent nature of the issues that we are discussing. And I would end with only, you know, one more comment, which is that if while this is true, that quote and unquote certain pre-secular identities are dear to us, therefore we can think, how do we get back to our families? How does the child get back to the parents? But think of the huge amount of population who want to forget their identities. Identity has been enough. Think of the massive flow of workers from one southern country to another. I have done myself work on migration from Bangladesh to West Bengal. And I have seen case after case where Muslim women would actually become Hindu women so that they can get jobs. After the Indian partition of 47, there is enough documentation to show how both Muslim women of Pakistan and Hindu women of India, when they got shelter in families of other religions, they were very happy. But it is the state which wanted to rescue these women. And therefore, that women were rescued from the families, and thereby it put an end to one of the dreams that I think humanity or groups always cherish, how to do away with the old and how to take on the new. Think of the labor flows from Philippines to the massive, you know, the entire area of the Far East and Southeast Asia. Do identities matter? Identities matter in the sense that the identities have to be shed. So it's not only... So therefore, what I'm trying to say, and these are things that are not fictive things. I'm not reporting to you fictive incidents. These involve millions of population. In tsunami, natural disasters, floods, and all kinds, people get lost. There is a tract in West Bengal, in the part of the country where I live, where each year about 100,000 people vanish because of the erosion of the riverbanks. And we do not know where they go. And this has been happening from kind of timeless time. What is the identity? So I think I do not want to go into the extreme, but all I want to say is that some of the binaries that we have received need to be questioned and they need to be problematized.
I think your reaction is telling. We've had a very fruitful panel. I'd like to say two or three things at the end, not trying to synthesize in any way. One comment I'd made is that modernity and rationality in themselves are traditions. This is a tradition among many other traditions. And in that sense, all societies are traditional, even modern societies are traditional. We have traditions, and these traditions are in dialogue. I'd like to come back to this word dialogue, the dialogic justice that Renabir has mentioned, which I think is very important because it's hidden in under most of the issues we've touched and the questions we've asked. The word dignity came up, which is something very interesting for a lawyer like me because it has almost absolutely no legal content except maybe respect for all human rights. But it's a very appealing concept precisely because we can put our aspirations into it and it has an attraction, and there is a research group in our law school to which Ranabir participates where we're trying to put content in that word dignity. And the dignity, one of the elements of the dignity that has been identified in our papers is the fact that individuals and communities are taken as legitimate interlocutors, equal interlocutors. And we are coming back to the idea of dialogue, of dialogic justice. We are equals, and we discuss, and we interpret. We interpret your tradition, we interpret my tradition, and we're trying to dialogue on the between these two interpretations. The last element I'd like to mention is the interconnectedness between all rights, the issue of development that has been mentioned. Amartya Sen has said, quite famously, that there has been no famines in democratic states because the political cost is distributed. And that was an illustration that civil and political rights were essentially linked to economic and social rights, and we could not think of the one without the others. And again, there is there a constant dialogue between rights that we have to entertain. I thank you all for being here. We have now a coffee break before going back into one or the other of the parallel panels in half an hour. In your name, I thank our panelists and the richness of their intervention.